Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, top of the evening to you, boyo and girl-o. It's St. Patrick's Day, and you're listening to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and tonight we're celebrating. No, not just because it's St. Patrick's Day. We're celebrating because I have been on Blog Talk Radio now for exactly 8 years. 8 years. I think in those 8 years, I probably missed six Tuesdays. I think I figured it out. Six Tuesdays. I was sick a couple of times. A couple of times the show didn't work. And then, of course, I was on hiatus for a few weeks. So it feels like 8 years, okay? It feels like 8 years. But it's nice because I built up a little bit of an audience. And I'm constantly amazed at people who say they've heard the show. Of course, now that I post the show to Facebook, a lot more people are listening, and that's nice. That's good. So tonight, what I thought I'd do, since it's my show and I want the night off, I thought I'd rebroadcast a show that aired last May of 2014, that actually kicked off the return of the Rhino Hour of Power with myself only as host. Jazz Shaw used to host, but he was very, very busy and didn't want to spend the time, so that's fine. But Jazz was kind enough to come on and help me relaunch the show, and where I conducted a two-part interview with my brother Terry Moran, of the chief ABC News foreign correspondent, former host of Nightline, former White House correspondent. And Terry and I had a fascinating conversation, and it's certainly the most popular show I've ever done. So without further ado, let's listen in. I think it's May 14th, 2014, Rhino Hour of Power.
Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the relaunch of the Rhino Hour of Power. I am your host, Rick Moran, the most famous rhino on the web, not named John McCain. Not really, but it sounds good. Anyway, thanks for joining me. It was a 6-7-8 week hiatus. It was nice. I recharged the batteries. I changed the show up a little bit. I actually got a call recorder, so now I can record conversations and interviews with all sorts of interesting people. And if I let you in on the secret of who's going to be on the show in the next few weeks, you'd jump for joy. But since I'm not going to let you in on the secret, you'll just have to wait like everybody else and find out at that time. So at any rate, bringing on right now my oldest and, well, I don't want to say dearest because that might denote some kind of sexual attraction, which
not that there's anything wrong with that.
That's anything wrong with that. Chaz Shaw, Hot Air. Chaz, how's it going?
Ah, thank you very much. And for everyone listening right now, I want to assure you, the revamped, retooled, returned from hiatus Rhino Hour of Power is making it known very clearly. If you look at the logo, the entire description of the show on the web, that this is in no way the old show that was Rick Moran and Jay Shaw, even though those of you tuning back in now might be hearing the exact same two voices that you heard before. This is, in fact, Rick Moran's show. Have no doubt about that. The second thing I want to say, I want to congratulate you on the retooling, on coming back. And I want to give huge props to your audio team, because that intro was really smoothly done. I enjoyed that.
It really was, yes. For those of you unaware, Jazz is a professional, or was a professional, sound engineer. And he has a $20,000 board sitting in his basement or something. Maybe not 20, maybe what, 15? Anyway, he expertly mixed that Take 5 Dave Brubeck classic with my voiceover. And actually, I asked him to make me sound like Robert Goulet, but he wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't you do that, Chaz?
I told you I would do it, but that's an extra filter. The filter costs $16,000 for single license use. If you want to pony up the cash, buddy, I'm there.
Okay, maybe I'll ask for donations.
There you go.
I'm in the chat room. I'll put a link to my PayPal account up, and you guys can all contribute to that. Very good. Okay, Jazz. Let's get into this here before I bring on my brother, Terry Moran. I conducted it's not an interview. It was a conversation actually with him this morning. Because he's in London, England. That's across the ocean, Jazz, in case you are geographically challenged.
Yes, I have followed some of your brother's career. I'm excited to listen to it myself. I see him on ABC frequently, and he pops up sometimes on the Sunday morning shows with little snippets coming in, particularly when there's any sort of international unrest, given his current position. And I just, before you announced you were going to be doing a segment with him on the show, I had just seen him the day before broadcasting live from Outer Moldavia or Transylvania or someplace like that with bombs going off in the background and stuff. So that should be exciting.
Yeah, it should be pretty good. So anyway, he'll be on 15 minutes or so, 15 or 20 minutes. And in the meantime, though, Jazz and I are going to talk about what I'm calling a comfortable event, an all-too-comfortable event. And what do I mean by that, Jazz? I mean that we are getting far too comfortable with mass shootings. These killers are, they don't shock us anymore. We have outrage fatigue. We can't get worked up about it anymore. In fact, you know, I refuse to write about it because it's just the same darn thing you're writing about, whether it's the school shootings in Newton or, you know, some rogue guy who gets into a movie theater and pours automatic fire into people. It's the same darn thing. You can have a checklist, Jazz, and I've got a checklist here. You want to hear my checklist of what people write about after every one of these stupid things?
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you. You have first gun controls. Check. Then no gun control. Check. Liberals are to blame. Check. Conservatives are to blame. Check. Men are to blame. Check. Women are to blame. Check. This time we have something pretty different, actually, and it's actually exciting. We have privilege, white privilege to blame. Wow.
Well, it is the hot topic this year. White privilege, check your privilege, white privilege, etc. What's that clown on MSNBC? How do you pronounce his name? Touré? He was making some comments this week that caught a lot of attention about Holocaust victims, because one member of a family that had escaped from the concentration camps had come over here and immigrated and become successful, and he went on Twitter responding to that person saying, well, it's a lot easier when you're white, for which he has drawn quite a bit of criticism. But, yeah, that's the hot ticket right now. So.
Yeah. But do you agree with that? I mean, this is people are trying to force a template of rationality. You know, giving all these reasons, he's really a woman hater, and he gets that from the conservative websites, or women are to blame because they're floozies or whatever. I don't know. It's the same darn thing over and over, and it's the same arguments made, and they're trying to force a template of rationality on someone whose mind is broken. There is no rationality in a broken mind. You have to be crazy to do what he did, to say the things he said. Mental illness, they might debate it, but how can you debate, being irrational? I don't understand.
I don't think anyone can bring any sort of argument that isn't going to make me basically tune out immediately to claim that there was some sort of rational foundation which this individual followed step by step that brought him to this point and then he made the decision to do this. Some of the more common ones, before we get to the really interesting one you found, which I find highly fascinating, apparently he was a frequent visitor to, and I don't even know the name of it, if I did I wouldn't send them any traffic, some website for men a pair of them that deal with some concept called men's rights, whatever, you can look that up. And another one that apparently teaches you how to score with the babes and sort of degrades any women who aren't willing to succumb to your amorous advances and to give you advantages and things like that. And he was a frequent visitor there, and he did certainly talk in his video a lot about, the women who rejected him and he was still a virgin and all this stuff. But for all of you out there trying to use this as some sort of rationale, I have news for them, and I'll just clue you in really quick, Rick. If even a measurable sliver of a percentage of the men in this country who had an incredibly hard or impossible time trying to get women to go to bed with them, or who had determined that women were all a gigantic pain in the butt, if even a tiny sliver of a percent of them rationally wound up at a, what one writer wrote is the logical extreme conclusion point of going and shooting up a bunch of women, Rick, the country would be empty. Almost everyone would be dead. The only remaining ones would be the guys who did it, and they would be in jail. It would be them and the guards. Everyone else would be gone. If this guy did not rationalize a chance to go on a killing spree by blaming the women who wouldn't sleep with him, he would have later turned around and rationalized it on the fact that he couldn't get a good job, or that he got a job but people didn't respect him, or the space aliens had abducted him one too many. He would have come up with something. The boy was broken. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's silly, but the game has to be played. I think we talked about this yesterday, or actually I talked about it with my brother this morning. That's where I remember talking about it. It used to be, 10 years ago before Twitter and Facebook and all that, it used to be a 24-hour news cycle. Now the news cycle is measured in 140 characters. And because of that, you have this absolute overarching necessity to attack anything, any excuse whatsoever, and it just doesn't contribute to broken politics. It contributes to an atmosphere that makes any kind of compromise or any kind of getting anything done at all impossible. It keeps the base of both sides on edge and ready for combat at the moment's notice. And, you can't say anything in this country. If it gets into a 140-character tweet, you're done for.
Oh, exactly. And you can never pass up, and again, I'm sorry to say to my conservative friends, this applies to both sides pretty much equally. You can never let a tragedy go to waste. I mean, if it's something that you can use to build whatever argument that you're making, whether it's that all men are scummy horned dogs or misogynists, or all white guys are racists, or everybody who believes in the Second Amendment is a killer and wants everyone to die, you know, whatever your argument is that week.
Right.
And the people arguing the opposite of each of those will find a way to turn it around 180 degrees and go, no, you're wrong because of blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, everybody's loaded for bear, ready to go. A new headline breaks. If it leads, it bleeds. You grab a hold of that and you fit it to your agenda, and you go and talk about it. And no, I didn't do it either. I did an open thread post for our readers because everyone was asking about it in the comments, and I just had essentially no opinion on it. No, it's just like, you want to talk about it? Here, go ahead.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. It's just useless, and it contributes nothing to the conversation, political, cultural, whatever. It's not a case for gun control. This guy, by the way, the Santa Barbara sheriff, apparently, and this is probably the only fact that we're going to stick in here, had the opportunity to take this guy into protective custody, put him in a mental institution for 48 hours, at which point, given his mood and what he was saying and telling people and writing about on Facebook, he would have been then committed for 14 days, at least, by the hospital staff. This is what they're able to do under the law in California. And that includes the police coming to his house and taking away all his guns. Now, just because they took away his guns doesn't mean he wouldn't go on a killing spree. After all, he killed three people with a knife. And he could have just as easily knocked on that girl's dormitory door, girl's sorority or whatever, and you know, gone slashing through the house.
And let's not forget car control, because he didn't kill anybody, but he did a good number on a few of them with a vehicle. So,
that's,
you know,
right.
they crazy people find a way. They do.
Exactly.
You know.
So it just makes the whole argument ridiculous.
Before we get to your interview, though, I do want you to take a moment, if we have the time, and tell us about this fascinating, you sent me an article about this fascinating new theory, which has to do with therapy.
The therapy culture. This was an article that appeared in Reason.com, the world-famous libertarian publication. And I'm going to try to get Nick Gillespie on as one of my guests, by the way, which should be interesting. Anyway, by Brendan O'Neill, one of their staff writers there. And he talks about the therapy culture being to blame, or partly to blame, or at least involved in the blame, for Mr. Rogers' rampage. And he points out that Roger had gotten therapy for 14 years, and that he might have been lurking on some of these websites. I'm looking for the exact quote. Many thinkers, he writes, have attacked the therapy industry's creation of a new and ravenous narcissism, which demands constant flatter feeding. In his classic 1979 book, Culture of Narcissism, the great Christopher Lash said, quote, the contemporary climate is therapeutic, not religious. He said therapy culture, the post-1960s obsession with self-reflection, had created a new narcissistic personality. It had given rise to individuals who could, quote, depend on others to validate their self-esteem and who cannot live without an admiring audience. I find that somewhat profound, actually.
I found it somewhat profound also.
I would hasten to point out, Jazz, that he can't mean all therapists. I mean, there are really, really good therapists out there. I know that there are some people who have been helped tremendously, who are on the edge of life and ready to end it, who have been helped tremendously by therapists. So we can't lump all therapists in with this therapy culture. But I think he's onto something.
I think there is certainly something to be examined in the idea of a therapy culture and the idea of this need for constant flattering, this narcissistic attitude, which some therapists may certainly build up in people. I think there are people who have the money and come from backgrounds who watch too much Sex and the City in the 90s. Who spend their lives going to therapists and maybe not particularly good ones. I'll just throw in the caveat that you did just very briefly. There are some people who can benefit tremendously and desperately are in need of therapy from good targeted therapists for specific problems. Not saying that's not the case. People who do it recreationally because, you know, they're unhappy with their dating life or their mom, you know, calls them too often, things like that. Yeah, that can get out of hand. It can probably be addictive. But in closing, I will take this back and say I poo-poo the idea that this event is directly related to this because, once again, just like I said about the people who are angry because girls won't sleep with them, if even a sliver of a fraction of a percentage of the people who spend a lot of time in therapy were going on killing sprees, we'd both be dead along with everyone else. So the author is assigning, I think, a little too much power to the problems inherent in this therapy culture, which is probably real to some extent, certainly worth examining, but I don't think we can put the blame for this broken, desperately sick maniac solely on the fact that he spent a lot of time in therapy.
I agree 100%. And with that, let's get to my interview with Terry. It lasts a half an hour, so without further ado, Rick Moran versus Terry Moran. Thanks for joining me tonight on this relaunch of the Rhino Hour of Power. With me as a guest this evening is a very special guest, my brother Terry Moran, who's chief foreign correspondent for ABC News, has worked at ABC News for many, many years, was formerly the White House correspondent and host of Nightline, you may recall. So, Terry, welcome to the show, brother.
This is going to be our most extended conversation in a while. We haven't kept up enough.
Probably in 30 years when we went out to dinner when you were an intern at the New Republic, and you had just got to Washington, and we went out to dinner. I think you paid, as I recall. But, it's great to have you. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Finally, I thought, what better time to do it than when I'm relaunching my show after an extended hiatus? Certainly we have a lot to talk about. That's for darn sure. You've been right in the middle of so much during your career. And, like I said, you started that career as an intern at TNR, but then you moved on to the Legal Times, which was, as I recall, a pretty much of a new publication at that time in the early 80s. Tell me about that experience, because that led directly to your participation in the Court TV channel, which, of course, launched your career. But tell me about Legal Times.
Well, Legal Times was a little sleepy trade newspaper, basically publishing court notices and maybe a couple of op-eds from judges. And then it was bought by Steve Brill, who founded The American Lawyer and later went on to found Court TV, a fine reporter himself. He'd written the definitive book at the time on the Teamsters and had ambitions to be something of a media mogul. And so he was buying up at rock-bottom prices these little trade newspapers, legal newspapers, in about half a dozen cities. And Legal Times is the one in Washington, D.C., and he hired journalists that he knew. My first boss at Legal Times was Jill Abramson, who's just left the New York Times.
How about that? Yeah.
Yeah, so it was an interesting crowd. But it was real journalism applied to the legal business and the legal industry. They didn't like it at first. They hated it because Brill was interested in everything from the amount of money they made to the amount of influence and power they exercised, to the way that they got business and which firm was up, which firm was down. They hated it, but it was a great training ground for me. It really was.
I can imagine. I remember, the getting that newspaper every morning was a treat because it, as you said, was the only newspaper really covering legal Washington, which included lobbying and the big lobbying shops, and it kind of was the first to expose them for their influence, which now of course is a huge industry.
Absolutely, it was on the leading edge of that curve, and Brill know, Steve was a mentor to me. The first day of work, I thought I was going to be covering lobbying. When I got there, they said, go up and cover the judiciary committees in Congress, and because we're going to expand into sort of the legal issues on Capitol Hill. And I said to Bill, I said, well, what should I look for? What would be a story? And he looked at me and he said, if it's interesting to you, it's probably a story. And that's the best advice I've ever had in journalism.
Yeah, that's good advice all the time, for sure.
Absolutely.
But then, was it your appearance on McNeil Lehrer that kind of boosted your stock to get to Court TV, or was that something separate?
It was totally accidental. It was because Steve had this idea. He had these little legal newspapers and the American Lawyer magazine, which was a National Magazine Award-winning magazine. I mean, there are a lot of major writers, Connie Brook from The New Yorker, James Stewart from The Wall Street Journal, Jill Abramson, a lot of really fine journalists came out of the American Lawyer, and people went into politics. Don Barrett, well, he had an eye for talent, Steve. And he had this idea, because he realized that at that point about 35 states had some form of cameras in the courtroom. And he went to Steve Ross, who was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, and something of a buccaneer, one of those 1980s communications buccaneer, and he said, I've got an idea for a cable channel. Let's just take the feed out of those courtrooms and put it on TV. Hmm. It'll be cheap, people will watch it. And Warner backed it. Time Warner backed it, and that's so. Steve came to me and said, "How would you like to travel around the country and cover trials?" And you know, it was actually right after the Clarence Thomas thing, and I was kind of sick of Washington, I must say.
Yeah.
I said, "It sounds good to me, but I don't think anybody's going to watch."
This is before the days when CNN, Fox, well, Fox didn't even exist, but when CNN, you know, wouldn't deign to cover a trial like the Menendez brothers. I mean,
that's right.
And so you had Court TV, and you had an instant audience of millions. How long after Court TV launched did the Menendez brothers trial begin?
I would say a couple of years, but before that, you know, it was the William Kennedy Smith trial. Which
oh, that, yes. Yes.
And then Rodney King. I mean, we had, there was an endless supply in the 90s. It was very, once again, kind of very lucky, serendipitous that I covered trials during what you might think of as a golden age. Yeah, in some ways. Although I liked the way Court TV did it at that time. Court TV turned into a very shouting kind of network. But Steve said, I'm not going to have a network that does free 'em or fry 'em. We're going to have lawyers on. They're going to explain what's going on in the courtroom, and nobody takes a position. And so it was, and we're covering every minute of it. And so, you know, it was sort of a lot. It was often quite dull. If you're just watching the recross of the prosecution's second expert witness, sometimes it wasn't that interesting. But Americans found it fascinating. It gave, I think, Americans, because it did treat it in a straightforward way, very objective, it gave Americans, I think, a little more power over their court system a little bit, because they could watch it, see what was going on, see that money makes a huge difference, see that some procedures work, some don't. My feeling has always been, if O.J. Simpson had been convicted rather than acquitted, there'd be a camera in every courtroom in the United States.
Really? I'll be darned.
Because people felt so bad about it, they blamed the camera in the courtroom. And to be fair, in that instance, everybody in that courtroom seemed to want to be a celebrity.
Yeah.
And it did distort the process. But, you know, that's L.A. It wasn't really the camera. That's more L.A. If you tried O.J. Simpson in Philly or, you know, Chicago or Houston, it would have been about a three, four-week trial, and he probably would have been convicted at the end of the day.
Uh-huh. Well, there are a lot of people in the African-American community who think that he was innocent. So, you know, there you have it. Those cameras in the courtroom may very well have prevented a riot, riots all across the country, considering the reaction of the African American community to his acquittal. But
well, it's interesting. The polls afterwards showed that the more people had seen of the actual grinding day-to-day testimony, the more they were inclined to say that the prosecution had not sufficiently proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. Well, that may be true. I don't know.
I think the whole thing
about the racist police guy, the police officer, the police detective.
Furman.
Yeah, that's his name. I think that was just smoke and mirrors. It had nothing to do with his guilt or innocence. But of course, it raised questions about the chain of evidence and all that other stuff. The jurors, I guess, who did a job that might be termed, what, the jury nullification? Is that what they were called?
Yeah. Well, they did that whole Furman thing. And all of it, Johnny Cochran, quite brilliantly, turned it into a political event. It really was about power. And you know, Mark Furman, you know, may have done everything right that night or not, I don't know, but he had a track record that I think for a lot of black people on the jury and elsewhere said, I know that guy. He cracked my cousin's head open, you know, or he pulled me over. You know, guys like that treat me badly. That was the perception.
Right.
And so Cochran turned it into a verdict on power in L.A., and O.J. was the beneficiary of it.
So anyway, lots of trials that, and of course Saturday Night Live did a parody that I will not link to.
Thank you.
In the comments.
Thank you.
But you know, hey, when you get parodied by Saturday Night Live, you've made it, brother. You made it.
I guess it was Kevin Nealon.
Yeah.
So.
Who looks nothing like you? Looks so much better than he does. So. We'll just leave it at that. So how long after, when exactly did you start to work for ABC News?
You know, just thinking of that, it was the fall of 1997. So I've been there now going on 17 years.
Yeah, that's so long.
Yeah.
You started as their legal correspondent, and you covered the Supreme Court. But to me, one of the most affecting stories you covered was when they sent you to Bosnia, and you covered the rape, and you visited some of the rape camps there and interviewed some of the women. That must have been wrenching.
Yeah, and that was really my first exposure. I'd been to Nicaragua in the 80s for the New Republic, just really for a couple of weeks. But I was hankering to get overseas. And that was really my first exposure to the kind of journalism, you know, that you do in those places, and the kind of things you see human life, the human person at the extremes, and you see nobility, you see brutality, you see, you know, courage, and you see the whole thing at a very high volume, as it were, and that's something that's attracted me, especially after working in Washington. I just kind of felt, and this time as well, I feel like I've gotten closer to real journalism, as it were.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, I'm sure. I was just curious, though. Then you went to you also covered war crimes trials at The Hague of some of those generals, correct? Or was it just Milosevic?
No, it was everything from low-level sort of torture or thug guys, all the way up to, I didn't do the Milosevic one. I did the two Bosnian Serbs, Karadzic and Mladic, who were tried in absentia. They've since both been captured, and both Mladic is dead. Karadzic, I believe, is still alive in captivity, in prison.
Right.
But I covered their trials in absentia, and that was at the precursor of the International Criminal Court. It was really the thing that got the whole, let's put these leaders on trial again, like we did after World War II, that whole movement that started with Bosnian war crimes trials. And I got a huge dose of that. I was in The Hague quite a bit, like for months at a time.
Nice city, I understand. I'm serious.
Well, look, it's worth going for the Vermeers. If you like painting, there's three. He was from there, and there's three or four in the museum there. It's fantastic. It is very. It's a very pleasant city. The port's a little rough around the docks, but it's quite nice. Although you know, my feeling after having covered that stuff for a while was that I was very skeptical of the whole project of international criminal law.
Right.
I wasn't quite sure where it came from. Who voted for it? Law has to have democratic accountability and legitimacy. And I also felt that making the lawyers the main arbiters of how to resolve conflict. In other words, we must put these people on trial. For the argument goes that it'll stop these crimes happening in the future. But sometimes peace requires other kinds of deals to be cut with the devil, or justice comes in different forms. And I'm just a little bit skeptical of the International Criminal Court. I think it's too much power to one dimension of statecraft. And it tends to be victor's justice, and it tends to be kind of toothless, and sometimes it actually prolongs wars. So I'm not a huge fan, having covered it up close.
Well, what do you think about, you call it victor's justice, and I would agree with that 100%. I thought that that even tainted the Nuremberg trials, although something had to be done. Some statement had to be made, I think, that, this was just, you can't go around killing 6 million people because of their religion. You know, that I think a statement had to be made there. But having said that, you know, we had the Japanese war trials, which were also, somewhat controversial at the time, especially the death sentences that were handed down. I would agree with the concept of international justice if it was across the board. But, you know, and I hate to say this as an American, but I've been one of the few conservatives, I think, who has accused our own government of torturing people under international law. And, you know, should these people, should George Bush be in the dock at The Hague?
Well, I'm not going to I can't take a position on that, but I will say I'm a bit skeptical of a prosecutor with a political agenda. Look,
right.
It happens even in domestic politics. So you don't like a particular leader, and you can, you know, in a country like the United States or Russia, or you can make a credible claim that some policy of theirs amounts to a violation of international criminal law. You could put the entire Chinese leadership on trial for slavery, I suppose, or, you know, Russia for aggression, or what, you know, whatever the crimes are that you choose. And that's my problem. Once you begin looking at all problems of power, problems of justice, problems of making peace in the world through the lens of the lawyer's understanding of criminal law, you begin to narrow your options. One thing statesmanship requires is flexibility. I think it's a tool in the toolbox, is the way I would say it. But I'd be very wary about it becoming dominant. And I think that the people who are part of this project think it should be always the first thing you do when somebody, you know. For example, I was just in Central Africa Republic, a country that I will confess I was completely unfamiliar with until I went there about a month. They're having basically a genocide, Muslims and Christians. The Muslims started, you know, looting the country and killing Christians. The Christians formed their own militias and are now, you know, giving what for to the Muslims. And it's just, it's horrific. It's just unbelievably horrific. And the most pressing need is to stop the fighting and get to the aid in there. And they're already drawn up indictments. Well, if you're one of the warlords, I mean, what's your incentive to stop fighting if you know that, you know, somebody from The Hague is going to put you in the dock and you're never going to see home again? There's a lot of that. I just think that the pressing problems of statesmanship are the solutions require more than international criminal law, and I know that project has a natural tendency to grow and to want power.
Well, sure. and that's why I would oppose any American being put in the dock, soldier, sailor, or president at The Hague for that reason. I mean, it's too problematic. We have remedies in the United States to take care of that, including the ballot box. And in case of somebody like Bush, who is out of office, disapprobation is an effective tool as well. And, you know, he's not a very popular man, even to this day. So I don't see any American being fairly tried at any international tribunal.
I think you're right about that. You also made a great point there. Local. I remember sitting in The Hague, which, as you say, is a nice place, and then to Bosnia and thinking, you know, what am I doing in The Hague? Why are all these people well-fed, you know, nice wines at night? Why is this thing done in Sarajevo? I mean, you know, Justice Jackson put it in Nuremberg for a reason. That's where the victims are. That's where the trauma occurred. You know, Rwanda, which is a country that today really, it's amazing how much it healed from the trauma of the genocide. There was a International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It was deeply corrupt at first. It did end up getting most of the big guys, actually. But there were, you know, massive slaughter. Rwanda has conducted its own local trials, so the International Human Rights Court doesn't like them at all. But it's amazing to see, because they mix tribal justice and law. It's amazing to see these killers come forward. They must confront the village or the neighborhood and the survivors and say exactly who they killed and how they killed them, and ask for forgiveness. And there are lots and lots of people in Rwanda who are being supported by the killers and the family, because then they pay reparations for their lives. It's an amazing system. You know, local is seems to me to be where justice can happen after these traumas, more than The Hague, which is quite abstract. It wants to make a great big point. That point needs to be made. Never again. It needs to be made again and again every time it happens. But as a first stop or the primary tool, I'd go with local.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating subject. Maybe we'll come back to it again sometime. But I wanted to move on to your stint as White House correspondent. You got that the job of following the Kerry campaign in 1999, and that must have been fun. A presidential campaign.
Gore.
I get those two confused all the time.
Well, yeah, you know what? It makes a little sense.
Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You began to cover the Gore campaign in 1999, and there's I'm so jealous because, you know, after reading Theodore H. White and all his books on making of a president, it just sounded like so much fun. But apparently, presidential campaigns have changed since the 1960s, and it wasn't quite as much fun as perhaps Theodore H. White and Merriman Smith and all the other old gang that covered those events for us back then had.
No, you know, it's not. It's a great adventure, though. You see the country. I've done, I guess, you know, 2004, some of 2008, and some of 2012, but mostly 2004 and 2008. And I did get the sense from New Mexico to Iowa to Hampshire, Ohio, Florida, that the country is engaged in some kind of decision making process. You can sense it. They're gelling. You go hear a candidate, especially in the early days, but even later at the big rallies, talk about education, and you see the parents lean in, or hug their kids, or you know, hold their kids, or when they talk about the war, you could hear a pin drop in the place where, you know, people knew the gravity of that, and the sense of the country moving towards decision is thrilling. Now, that said, political journalism, you're right, has changed, and it's not as much fun. There's a lot less drinking and carousing, and by that, there's a lot less humanity. I remember toward the end of one of those campaigns, maybe 2004, some of the old bulls got back on the bus, Jack Jamond and David Broder.
Oh, wow.
took a trip with us at somewhere, right? And it was towards yesterday, so we got off the plane, we went to the event, and they have a press area where they've got power and, at that point, hardline, you know, communications, what do they call that, you know, Ethernet connections and everything else. And sure enough, you know, all of us kind of wonky Washingtonian types today, you know, opened up our laptops and plunged their face directly into the screen. And I remember looking up, and Jamond and Broder were standing off to the side with their notebooks, looking at us, obviously bewildered. What are these guys doing? there's 20,000 people to talk to out there. You know, what are they doing? And it's because the story increasingly exists in the virtual realm rather than the real realm. I mean, Drudge drives it, Huffington drives it, and that viral sensibility drives it. So that you go to Truth or Consequence of New Mexico, I'm making that one up, but you go to Alamogordo, or you go, you go to Santa Fe or Albuquerque, pick your town in any of the battleground states, and there's something to learn, and there's something that you're seeing, and people that you're hearing, and yet it's whatever the little blip of the day in the virtual world that's driving traffic and driving the conversation is really the story. And so I came to love American politics because I believe in it. Unlike most political reporters, I'm convinced the American voter is essentially very intelligent in his or her own way about his or her own interests in life. People know what they want in their lives. They know what they need in their lives. They know who's BSing them. They're pretty smart. But I grew to really dislike American political journalism, which seems to me to be all about how they play the game, the process stuff. It's not about the great adventure that you're actually on when you're covering a campaign. So I kind of regret that about political journalism today. I think it is a problem. I think the medium expanding into, what you're doing, what Vice is doing, all kinds of other people are doing, does empower people. There's no question. Because mainstream media style of covering politics, I just don't think is serving the country well.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to have a little discussion about journalism later, so we'll maybe come back to this. But just to digress a bit, these are in the days before Twitter and before social media, when you had a 24-hour news cycle. Now the news cycle can almost be defined in 140 characters.
Yeah, great point. That's a great point.
And so what you have are the issue of the hour, not of the day, of the hour. This Elliot Rodger thing in the U.S., I don't know if you probably haven't been following the shooting.
I have. It's awful.
It's just awful. And, I had railed against this for years. The idea that you can take somebody with a mind that broken, that incredibly broken mind of the shooter, and try to put a template of rationality on it is absurd. It's absolutely crazy. So you have the right blaming the left for the shooting. You have the left blaming the right. You have people saying that it's because he's a racist, because he's a misogynist. I mean,
right.
He's crazy, guys.
Right.
He's nuts. All.
And he's crazy in a way that is the hardest to deal with because he's high functioning crazy.
Yes.
Somebody who says there's a giant caterpillar trying to eat me. That's easy. That guy doesn't get to buy any guns. That guy doesn't get to wander the streets. Basically, that person gets, hopefully medicated and cared for and all the rest of it. It's the person who speaks so beautifully, clearly high-functioning in a lot of ways. I covered the Unabomber trial. That guy was genius-level intelligent.
Yeah.
And he was defending himself in the court, so he was, and the federal government had a psychiatrist look at him. And she came out and she said, he's one of the most mentally disturbed people I've ever met. And I was like, wow. Because in the court, he was able to muster his way through arguments. He was very impressive. But it's that high-functioning insanity that's just it's really hard to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I'm just at a loss now because this is part of a political journalism now, covering crazy people. And trying to give political motivations, political motivations for his actions in order to wound the other side. It's just crazy.
Right.
I was going to say we got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to get on to at least start talking about your stint as a anchor at Nightline because you covered so many incredible stories. That must have been tough following up Ted Koppel.
Oh, man.
That must have been
Ted
tough.
Ted Koppel is a hero of mine. I mean, he's just a He was just an amazing journalist. You know, by 2005, he'd been doing it for 25 years and was only doing it 3 days a week, and the format hadn't changed in a long time. And, you know, they basically were ready to kill the program, and he was ready to be done with it. So, you know, they gave three of us a shot and wanted to change the program. Well, you know, there's no way even three of us together were going to add up to one Ted couple. Ted gave some advice, though. He said he was always a gentleman about it. You know, he must not have liked the new Nightline. I'm sure he didn't. But he was always a gentleman, and he said, very classy guy. And he said, don't worry. He said, you don't have to hit a home run every time up. You're on five nights a week. Just keep at it. And we did. I mean, at first, we got absolutely crucified by every single critic in America who hated us, and the audience deserted us in droves. And then, you know, we kind of got our feet underneath us. I mean, I was doing stuff in Iraq and Afghanistan, in other words, and yet we were also doing some celebrity interviews, you know, which actually ended up not working for us. We stopped doing that. People didn't come to Nightline for that. But we expanded religion coverage, which people loved. And we ended up actually, you know, putting the show back at the number one rated show at 11:30 against Letterman and Leno.
Yeah.
And that was pretty, I thought that was a pretty good accomplishment. But following Ted was just brutal.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I thought I had to develop a thick hide at the White House because, you know, no matter which president you cover, half the country thinks you're a traitor.
Right.
No matter what. So,
yeah.
But really, people just loved Ted so much, respected him so much, that when we came in and tried to change the show, we just got absolutely destroyed in the ratings and by critics.
Yeah. And I'd like to continue talking about Nightline, Terry, but we'll save that for the second half of this interview, which will be played next week on the Rhino Hour of Power, same time, same place. So join us then. What do you make of that, Jazz?
I thought it was a good interview. You had some very good observations. You sort of retreaded the conversation we had about the shooting with him, but
yeah,
I like hearing his perspective.
Yes, I couldn't avoid it. I mean, it's what I think, and we were talking about it. So what can I say? Yeah. So the second half of that interview will be a broadcast next week, at 8 p.m. Eastern is when the show starts, and we'll probably have to get some more bandwidth there because we're getting slammed. So all you people out there want to hear the second half, tune in next week and we'll satisfy your desire for more Terry Moran. Whatever. To continue with the show, I just couldn't believe this. I got an email around 6 o'clock tonight. It was an excited announcement from the Republican National Committee. It was so exciting. Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson is going to be speaking at the Republican Leadership Conference in New Orleans next month. Oh, my God, be still my heart.
Yeah, I got the same announcement.
What absolutely floors me about this is the tone deafness of the Republican Party. This is a guy... You know, and I'm not going to repeat what he said about gays because it's disgusting for one thing, but it's bigoted until all get out for another. I don't care if it is his religious beliefs. Religious beliefs can be bigoted. I mean, mixing of the races was justified on religious grounds. So, you know, I just don't understand. And, of course, it wasn't so much, you know, you can excuse his ignorance about gays, you know, based on his backwoods nature and all that. But what really got me were his comments about African-Americans pre-civil rights laws, where he said, they're happy. But I got the quote right here. He said, "I never with my eyes saw the mistreatment of any black person," he says. "Where we lived, not once. Where we lived was all farmers. The blacks worked for the farmers. I owned cotton with them. I'm with the blacks. And he didn't say this, but I'm going to add, some of my best friends are black. I'm with the blacks because we're white trash. We're going across the field. They're singing and happy. Oh, my God. You know, isn't this tone-deaf jazz? Isn't this an example of the not just the Republicans, but conservatives' dated community, where you have to, you know, where so many people are, you know, left out in the cold
because of their race or their sexual orientation. That depends who is listening to this and who the target audience is, and also the background of when you hear some of these people talking, and Phil's certainly one of them. Now, to your first point, even inviting the guy, you know, to that conference, and I've been to a couple of Republican leadership conferences myself, Phil Robertson is incredibly popular with the base. You can sit and rant and rave against him all you like, but this is a party that is meant to keep the base inside the corral, and Phil is very popular. So, no, it's not tone deaf to have him speaking there. If you had him at the RNC in 2016 as a featured speaker, and you're in a tight race and you want to capture the middle, that's another matter. But for something like this, not really. As to the things that he said, believe it or not, my views on some of this, because I've had to talk to lots and lots of folks and engage with other writers and readers about it, and I've gotten a bit of a different perspective on Phil. First of all, it's very easy to flatly say, oh, well, if you condemn homosexuals, then you're a homophobe and, you know, you're a bad person, et cetera. And even if it is found in your religion, well, that could be bigoted. Well, that's easy to say if you disagree with them, but I don't know. Some of these people do not seem to be people who are looking for a chance to grind a political axe by taking on gays. I mean, a lot of people really do believe this, heartfelt belief that it's a sin. And I know the Bible says you're supposed to, hate the sin but love the sinner. And some of them don't seem to be managing that. But, yeah. You know, they don't take issue with what he said. And there's a lot of folks that aren't just that far right 10% of the Republican Party in this country who also have serious issues with it. So, no, I wouldn't make that blanket statement. And finally, as to the statement about the blacks, this one's really going to blow you away since you asked me. But, you know, I know a lot of people who say that and had that experience. Not young people today, not people I work with, not colleagues, but older folks. And when you talked about having this discussion, I was reflecting back on when I was growing up. I think I might have mentioned before, my father was he was a war hero. He's a great man in many ways. He was also an incredible world-class racist and just, you know, hated anybody who basically wasn't him. But he was raised by my grandfather, who was also a racist, but really only against the Japanese. He never seemed to expand his racism out any further than having a hatred for the Japanese. And he would tell stories, he and my grandmother, from the Depression era. We lived out in upstate New York in an entirely white area. There were no black people around. There was just white people living on farms. Their only exposure to any black people were what today you would refer to in a historical sense as hobos. There were literally people who rode the rails, and we grew up right next to railroad tracks. And they would come and work the farm and not get paid money because there was no money during the Depression. But they would get three meals that day, and if they were going to spend the night, they would spend the night in the barn. And the next day, frequently, they would, you know, they've eaten and done some work, and they would hop on the trains and go away. And my grandfather would say the exact same thing Phil Robertson said. And he was not a fan of black people. He didn't know any. If he'd known more, he probably would have hated him too. But yeah. All I'm saying is people from a different generation, or those maybe raised by that generation and living in a insulated area, and I hate to generalize, but very frequently in the South, where these are all the opinions that all your friends say and all your family says, you know. And you hear things like that, and you sort of take it in, and I think there's absolutely a chance that, you know, Phil is not out there saying that because he's trying to find the right code words and dog whistles to say horrible things about black people. Maybe that's his life experience. That's the stories he was told. You know?
Okay.
Does that make it right? Obviously not.
Does it?
So does that add an element of tone deafness to it? To have somebody who's probably with little provocation going to go off and start repeating all that, not very good. But before we start hating on Phil, maybe it's worth understanding where he came from.
Okay, I understand where he came from. You and I grew up in a time. We were young when black people could not sit at a lunch counter in the South, could not use a bathroom in a department store.
This is true.
And we, to the point where we now have a black president. That is, it. And I wrote at the time in 2008, I had trouble believing it. It just, it didn't register. And so I understand where that fella Sterling is coming from, where Phil is coming from, where people of our generation are coming from. But we, you and I, and a lot of other people, overcame that attitude by learning. And what we learned was that it was a facade put up by black people to appear happy when they were being horribly, nauseatingly oppressed. And I don't, you know, I don't forgive it. I don't excuse it. I don't even want to explain it. It's wrong to think that. Not when the right way to think, and there is a right way to think on this, not when the right way to think is sitting a couple of keystrokes away on your computer. Okay, there's just no excuse for it. And I think that's the attitude that you have to take and not invite him to an important event of the Republican Party.
Well, I've said what I have to say on it. I'm saying I can see why he's there for that event, and I can see why not everyone is upset with him as you are. Lots of people are. The majority are. But there's a lot who aren't.
So we pander now to what, 25-30% of the Republican Party? We pander to their prejudices, to their bigotry, to their hatred. You know, that's no way to run a party. It's why I'm a rhino, and a proud rhino, by the way. If you haven't gotten that by now, new listeners out there, I am a proud rhino. I am pleased as punch not to be associated with a party or with people who think they're conservatives, who like Phil Robertson or Todd the Magic Womb Aiken. You know, these people, I'm proud not to associate with them, not to have my name associated with them. So if that makes me a rhino, thank God for that. I'm sure you feel the same way, don't you, Jazz?
In a lot of those cases, because I disagree I also find that there is a right way of thinking and a wrong way of thinking, and I think I'm more on your side on the right way of thinking. But I collide with enough of these people in a country that does have free speech just to recognize not everyone agrees, and they think they're thinking the right way, and I'm wrong.
Yeah. So, yeah, I really think that he's perfectly free and should be absolutely free, and we would all die to make sure he's free to say what he wants. But we're also free to criticize the hell out of him, and that's what I'm doing. So anyway, Jazz, we've reached the end of our hour.
Ooh.
As always, a real pleasure to have you on.
Well, welcome back once again.
Yeah, and we'll have you on again not too soon. Not too... You try me, boy. You try me.
We'll see.
Yeah, no, we'll
you'll come,
back,
you'll come crawling back.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, expect a call, a frantic call at 6:30 next week. When my scheduled co-host cancels on me. But yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. As always, a good time was had by all.
Indeed.
So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.